everybody. We will get started. And thank you all for being here. This is a panel about reporting on the rights of nature. My name is Katie Surma, and I am a journalist at Inside Climate News. I am based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I've had the good fortune of getting to report on this movement as part of my beat for the past year and a half. And we have some great speakers today. And the way this will work, I'll introduce them. And then I've asked Thomas to do a little primer on the rights of nature, because it is something that is sort of newer to the US, to journalists, and it might be helpful to just have sort of a shared understanding of what the movement is. So Thomas, as I mentioned, Thomas Lindsay, he serves as a senior attorney with the nonprofit Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights. He drafted the first rights of nature law in a rural Pennsylvania community in 2006. He also assisted with drafting the rights of nature provisions in the Ecuadorian Constitution and the City of Pittsburgh's 2010 rights of nature law. He served as special legal counsel to over 100 municipal governments in the U.S. and teaches continuing legal education classes for lawyers on rights of nature issues through Lawline. He is admitted to practice law in the 3rd, 4th, 8th, and 10th Circuit Courts of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Mother Jones, Forbes, and the Musician. And then we also have Elliot Moffitt. Yes. Elliot is a member of the Nez Perce tribe. He's a co-founder of the indigenous nonprofit Nimiipuu. He is the founder and president of Protecting the Environment, a tribal advocate and environmental activist. He's a former member and officer of the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee. He's semi-retired and is living on the Nez Perce Indian Reservation. In Canada. So let's get started with a brief presentation on what is the rights of nature.
Great. Thanks, Katie. So now to the dreaded PowerPoint. So lawyers can talk forever. I'm a litigator, so we can talk forever. So what we wanted to do this morning was to give kind of an overview of the rights of nature. What is it? Where has it happened? What's happening currently? What does it mean? You know, all that good stuff. And so the first question that we come to is, what is the rights of nature, right? And it's the recognition by legislation, so written law, adopted a statute or by a municipal code or regulation, some kind of written law or jurisprudence, so judge-made law, of the legally enforceable rights of nature as a whole or species and ecosystems. So some people's brains kind of explode at this point, and they say, well, wait a minute, rights are for humans. We're used to human rights. We're used to the Bill of Rights, the US Constitution. We're used to state bills of rights. And yes, that's the context in which we generally discuss rights. But this is something different. It's about taking that highest value that we give in the law towards enforceability for legal protection, and conferring those rights on nature. So think of a river as having rights, or a forest as having rights. So legally enforceable rights conferred on nature. Again, highest form of legal protections in written law, this rights concept. And it's generally seen by people working in the field, lawyers and activists alike, as an effort to augment and strengthen existing environmental laws by heightening the types of protections afforded to nature. So basically changing how we treat nature under the law. Next slide. So people, next question people ask, okay, rights, does my river have free speech, all right, or due process protection under the law? Well, no, that's silly. We're talking about rights that are customized to those individual agencies. So we're talking about the right to exist, kind of like a right to life, for rivers or forests or other ecosystems. The right to thrive, the right to regenerate, these are all rights that have been written into law already in different jurisdictions, not just here in the US, but Canada and Europe and Ecuador and Bolivia and other places that we're talking about. A right to regenerate, right to evolve, the right to perform natural species or ecosystem functions, the right to be restored, the right to restoration, the right to habitat, the right to clean air, clean water, and the right to flow, the right to a healthy environment and climate. So some of the rights have been wrapped up in this kind of legal rights jurisprudence that's begun to happen around the world. Next. So why do we need rights of nature? So I don't think we would be here today, and probably a lot of you not at this conference, if our current system of environmental protection was actually working. But it's not working. And the fact is that there are a variety of reasons why they don't work. One is things like agency capture, you know, where industry essentially hires from regulators, and you have that kind of crossover in regulatory agencies. But there's a bigger issue here. It's not just about the players. It's not just about having a better 502CA little I, little Roman numeral 2 little I in the regulations about water quality. It's the fact that today's environmental laws treat nature as a commodity or as property under the law. So under our Western system of law, nature is treated as property or a thing under the law. So property or a thing without even the basic right to exist. And of course, as we probably all recall from our history classes, there was a time in history when women were considered things back in the 1840s. And African Americans or slaves were considered things. Women's rights were derivative through their husbands or oldest male family members. But they were property under the law, as were African Americans, property under the law. Today, nature has that same kind of component, that it's treated as property or as a thing under the law without even that basic right. Our environmental laws basically legalize environmental harm. This is not the way we usually see environmental laws. We see them as protective. But in essence, those environmental regulations that we have in place today, I spent a decade litigating most of them, they permit environmental harm to occur. The joke is we don't call them permits for nothing. They actually legalize certain harms to occur under that regulatory framework. They authorize the use and exploitation of nature as a thing, and those include things like filling wetlands, carbon dioxide pollution, fracking through aquifers, those types of things. So again, seeing environmental laws as a legalization of certain types of environmental laws basically is a permit for those kinds of harms to occur.
Next slide.
So again, why do we need rights of nature? Why are existing environmental laws inadequate? Again, the law views the natural environment as property whose use is to be regulated by law. And there's also, this is a little bit in the weeds, but current environmental law in the U.S. and other places is actually constrained by our constitutional restraints. So the U.S. Constitution talks about property, can't take property without just compensation under the constitutional constraints. So even environmental laws that we have in regulations run up against those constraints. That's why you see the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on waterway protections, what the jurisdiction of Congress is over that, and the taking of private property that can actually violate the constitutional provisions and thus constrain the reach of current environmental laws. And finally, that last one, which I don't need to talk much about, but we're going to the next slide, overlapping environmental crises attest to the failure of the current environmental law. We're fucked. And so we could just have a big slide that just says that, but instead we come at it from this direction. Next slide. These are just a few of the consequences of treating nature as a thing, which we're all familiar with. Ecosystem collapse, we use the coral reefs citation here, disappearing by 2100. Species extinction, 1 million species already face extinction from the IPPB panel. Climate change, 10 warmest years, 2013-2021. The elephant in the room, which is that the most pessimistic projections of climatologists are turning out to be downright optimistic in the scheme of things. So consequences of treating nature as a thing, consequences of how we try to regulate the use of nature as property. Next slide. rights of nature, this concept of legally enforceable rights for ecosystems, has indigenous origins. A lot of people like to trace it back to 1972. Yes, people put a year on it. And that was the year that the U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Douglas issued a dissent in a Supreme Court opinion, actually suggesting that we recognize rights of nature. So in the United States, there's a U.S. Supreme Court decision back in 1972 that first used that concept about nature having standing and having rights. A lot of Western lawyers traced back to that particular year when there was also a law review article done by a law professor known as Christopher Stone, who wrote a tract that was entitled, Should Trees Have Standing? Basically, should trees be able to go to court? Should forests be able to go to court? Getting rid of that Western European kind of veneer, indigenous communities have always seen nature as not being property, as having a different kind of status, not being owned and not being property. So First Nations treat nature as something that can't be owned. First Nations tend to speak about nature as a living being or as a relative, something much different than Western culture treats nature as. Next slide. So these are the contrasting worldviews, kind of between an indigenous worldview and a Western worldview, and how they treat nature. Indigenous communities talk about nature as a living being. The Anishinaabe people talk about the flying people, the swimming people, and the singing people, so the birds and the fish. And Yurok Nation talks about the Klamath River as being a relative or a living being. So kind of an indigenous worldview of nature and the world versus this Western worldview where nature is a dead thing. Nature is dead. It's to be regulated, it's to be exploited. We may want to regulate its exploitation a little bit better, but that's where our conversation tends to stop and start. Should we have more regulation or less regulation? My favorite quote, and I use favorite in quotes itself, from Sir Francis Bacon, and you probably didn't think you were gonna be talking about Sir Francis Bacon today. But Sir Francis Bacon said, the goal of Western civilization was to torture nature on a rack to extract her secrets. Tortured nature on a rack to extract her secrets. I can't think of any more disjunction between putting nature on a medieval torture instrument and talking about the flying people, the swimming people, and the singing people. There's two different worlds here between Western and indigenous thought. Next slide. Municipal and tribal rights of nature laws. As of 2023, amazing as it is to still say, over 36 municipal and tribal governments have adopted rights of nature laws across the United States. That began back in a little place called Tamaqua Borough in Pennsylvania back in 2006, showing my age at this point, but I helped to draft that law that was passed in that particular municipality. It was basically to stop toxic waste from being shipped into the municipality. The good people of Tamaqua recognized that rivers and waterways had certain legally enforceable rights within Tamaqua. And, of course, the city of Pittsburgh, one of the largest municipalities to adopt the rights of nature law, in that case, to protect the three rivers flowing through the city of Pittsburgh from fracking activities within the municipality, passed unanimously by the elected city council back in 2010. Next slide. What's in these things? Well, they all have some commonalities, and these are the commonalities. They all recognize rights. This is not about saying we love nature. This is not saying, wouldn't it be great if we protected nature better? These laws actually recognize legally enforceable rights. So recognizing nature, ecosystem, species as having legally enforceable rights. As for enforcement, they generally denote either any resident of the community to step into the shoes of the ecosystem to sue on its behalf, or designates government or governmental official or an ombudsman to have standing in courts to actually represent those ecosystems. So just to pause for a second, we've been moving fairly quickly, but imagine a court case in which a river is a plaintiff. Not a human, not a corporation, but river as a plaintiff. That's happened. It's happening in the U.S. right now. We're going to talk about some of those enforcement cases. So one of the big problems with environmental laws currently is standing. Can't get in the door unless you have some kind of financial or pecuniary interest in the exploitation of the ecosystem or use of the ecosystem to get into the courthouse doors. This eliminates that issue by placing the ecosystem in the position of the plaintiff. So harm flowing to the plaintiff being the ecosystem itself. The other commonality is remedy, restoration is a remedy. Believe it or not, in federal environmental cases today, if there's a judgment and a ruling and money has to be paid, it doesn't necessarily go back to restore the ecosystem. It goes into the general fund, the general treasury, to maybe pay down the debt. I don't know. But it rarely goes to restore the ecosystem. That's the subject of the lawsuit in the first place. Implementation, this also means overhauling regulations and codes, so changing laws, that zoning laws, municipal planning laws, watershed protection laws, to recognize the passage of the rights law. But again, before we leave this slide, legally enforceable rights for ecosystems, not just resolutions or feel-good stuff, but legally enforceable rights. Next slide. Not surprisingly, tribal and First Nations have led the way with rights of nature laws and resolutions. This is a smattering of those tribes. They include the Ho-Chunk in Wisconsin, the White-Earth Band of Ojibwe, which is the Chippewa in Minnesota, Ponca Tribe in Oklahoma, the Yurok Tribe in Northern California, the Menominee in Wisconsin, the Nez Perce Tribe, which Elliot's going to talk about their work with the Snake River. In 2020, the Oneida in Wisconsin, and the Innu, one of the Innu councils in Canada. The first rights of nature law was passed in Canada in 2021 to protect the Magpie River near Quebec. And it was passed by an indigenous community partnering with a Western Canadian municipality to pass that law. Next slide. Ecuador. So a lot of people have heard about rights of nature. The first word out of their mouth is Ecuador. And for good reason. It was the first national constitution to enshrine the rights of nature in 2008. And we had the good fortune of going to Ecuador and sitting with the constitutional delegates and talking with them about what was happening in the U.S., helping them draft some new language for the national constitution. Next slide. So what does it say? Well, this is what it says. Overwhelmingly ratified by the public in 2008, has a bunch of different provisions dealing with rights of nature. These are the three primary ones. Recognizing nature's right to exist and maintain and regenerate its life cycle, structure, functions, and evolutionary principles. Right to restoration in Article 72. Article 73, that the state has a responsibility to actually provide for enforcement of these rights. So those are the three primary provisions made into the Ecuadorian Constitution, led by a very progressive reformer who was president of the Constitution, and pressure from indigenous communities to do something, to actually change the DNA of the national constitution to recognize indigenous sovereignty, but also recognize new and better ways to protect the natural environment. When we were there, the indigenous communities were blockading the road leading up to the Constitutional Assembly. So just to give you an idea of how different that is. Oh, we had our own blockades here on January 6th, I guess. That's it. But the indigenous communities were actually blocking the delegates' passage and demanding the passage of rights of nature legislation. So it's pretty extraordinary. Next slide. People have called the Ecuadorian Constitution a turn of Copernican proportions. That it shifted things to that extent. Won't go in detail through these cases, but these are the leading ones. The first case was the Vilcabamba River case, in which the Vilcabamba River was the plaintiff, using these constitutional provisions to stop a road widening project that was affecting its flow. It was the first case in the world, outside indigenous communities, in which a judge ruled in favor of the river and ordered the local governments to stop polluting the river. The shrimp farming case was an application of the rights of nature early on in 2015 to stop a shrimp farm permit in a mangrove habitat. The one folks have heard of the most probably is the Los Cedros case. It was the cloud forest litigation, which was sought to overturn mining permits in the cloud forest on the basis of the rights of nature provisions. Constitutional Court, which is the highest court looking at constitutional issues in the country, revoked those mining permits and threw them out, declaring that the rights of nature prohibited, rights of nature provisions prohibited the issuance of those permits in the first place within that cloud park. Great case, the Estrelita case. Not many folks have reported on it, but it applied rights of nature, separate case, It applied rights of nature provisions to an animal species for the first time. So not just ecosystems, habitat, writ large, 30,000 feet, but down to an individual species member, recognizing that species member's having rights. We always have the caveat, the Mirador mining cases where rights of nature was applied or attempted to be applied over extraction of mineral interests and oil blocks was a losing case. We think that jurisprudence is slowly changing, but it's one of the places where it hasn't been as effective as we would have hoped. Conclusions coming out, nature is a subject of rights, as affirmed by the highest courts in Ecuador many times now. People have standing to evoke those rights, and there's been widespread applications in different kinds of laws within Ecuador. Next slide. Where else have rights of nature laws been passed? In addition to Ecuador, Bolivia has a rights of mother earth law. It's a national law. Uganda amended their National Environmental Act to include rights of nature several years ago, so national legislation. New Zealand, people may have heard about the Whanganui River and the national forest there is receiving some kind of legal personhood. So being treated as a kind of person with rights under a co-management plan with the Crown to manage those properties. Panama is the recent new addition, passing a national law in Panama. Spain also has a national law. State and local laws, Brazil has passed a number of laws at the local government level. Mexico, Canada, first rights of nature law passed a couple years ago. In the US, of course, we have those 36 municipalities now, including, may come as a surprise, Orange County, Florida, became the largest municipality in the United States to pass. A lot of people say, is there any nature left in Orange County, Florida? In Orange County, Florida, they passed, were the largest municipality to pass the rights of nature law back in 2020. 1.5 million people, 89% of the vote, recognizing legal rights for the Wekaiba and Econlachahatchee rivers in Orange County. So 36 communities in the U.S. Local policies. Northern Ireland, several district councils, which are akin to our county governments, have passed resolutions dealing with rights of nature. We're headed there in 2 months to help some of those local councils convert those into binding laws. England has been an especially active area. In the last 6 weeks, a district council south of London passed a resolution committing the council to pass the first English rights of nature law within the next couple of years around the River Ouse. It's an unfortunate name for a river, but it's O-U-S-E, River Ouse, south of London. And in Australia, some local governments have passed planning laws incorporating rights of nature principles. Next slide. Rachel was going to be talking about this one, the Rights of Sea Turtles Law, which just passed in Panama, turtle species under threat from certain kinds of development and other activities have been recognized as having rights, basically as the implementation of the recently passed Panama law. Applies to public and private entities, right to exist, habitat, freedom from pollution, enforcement, implementation on the behalf of the government, and an outright prohibition on certain activities that would harm sea turtles. So rights of sea turtles law, first marine mammal protected under this rights of nature framework that had begun in the Panamanian constitution, Panamanian national law. Other court decisions. So, to our surprise, I think, working in this field for a long time, that it had all stemmed from written law for a while, for about 15 years. So, people would write law, the law would pass, there would be enforcement cases. To our surprise, in 2016, some courts started borrowing the concept without written law in place. So, judges using unrelated cases to actually find that the rights of nature were a new emerging international norm of environmental protection. Drawing on the Ecuadorian constitutional law, some drawing on the US experience and the laws that have passed. In 2016, the Constitutional Court of Colombia recognized the rights of the Atrato River. Not through written law, nothing was passed, but judges actually pulling it into their courts and making it part of the jurisprudence for that country. In India, High Court has recognized the rights of the Ganges. Some glaciers have received rights underneath those rulings in India and other ecosystems. So the India stuff has been particularly exciting to us. In Bangladesh, the Supreme Court has recognized the rights of all rivers in 2019. So again, replication, duplication, not through written law and enforcement cases, but directly through these courts acting as judicial activists and pulling this new model of environmental protection into play. Next slide. The U.S. enforcement of rights of nature in U.S. communities and tribal courts. So in the U.S., and we're almost to the end here, three enforcement cases have been filed in the U.S. Up until this point, one of the cracks about rights of nature in the U.S. Has always been, yes, these places have passed it, but there's never been any enforcement, and they're not doing anything on the ground. Well, that started to change over the last year and a half, just to show how new this stuff is. And these are the three cases. Next slide. So there are three cases that have been filed in the U.S. around rights of nature, and these are the main ones. There have been a couple others where ecosystems have sought to intervene in existing cases. I was part of one of those cases, and the judge allowed the ecosystem to be in oral arguments for a couple different cycles and listed as an intervening party. This doesn't include those, because that's more in the weeds, but these are the direct enforcement cases that have been filed. The first one was a case known as Wild Cypress Branch versus Beachline South Residential. It was brought to county court in Orange County, Florida, to enforce the recently passed initiative that gave the Wekiva Pecan-Lacachi River rights as part of that ballot initiative in 2020. And it was brought to try to stop a 1,900-acre development that was going to destroy about 100 acres of wetlands. The Orange County law recognizes wetlands as having the right to exist, a right to life, basically, for wetlands. This development was going to destroy 100 acres. The confrontation was between those parties. The developer was sued, but also the state of Florida, because the regulatory agency was going to issue a permit and eventually did issue a permit for it. The court case was about overturning that permit, arguing that a state can enable violation of the rights of nature by issuing a permit to try to legalize the activity. So that case, Orange County, Florida. The second case, which is, I won't say more interesting, they're all really interesting from the perspective of a litigator, but was the Minomen case. In 2018, the White Earth Band of Chippewa in Minnesota, with our help, passed a rights of wild rice law. So wild rice is a cultural imperative for the Ojibwe, the Anishinaabe people in Minnesota. And the state of Minnesota had issued a 1 billion gallon water withdrawal permit to the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline, which is scheduled to bring tar sand oil down from Canada into the US, contending that the dewatering using that water extraction violated the rights of wild rice that had been recognized in the 2018 law. This case was not brought in Western court, it was brought in tribal court. So tribal courts being used to kind of begin to enforce and expand jurisdiction over these rights of nature laws. But that was purely a case in which Minomen was the plaintiff in the tribal court. So in the first case, Wild Cypress Branch, the stream was the plaintiff. The stream that was protected by the Orange County law was the plaintiff. In the wild rice case, Minomen is the plaintiff. And the tribe was also a co-plaintiff, but the suit was brought against the state of Minnesota to stop that regulatory permit from issuing. And then the third case, also fascinating from my neck of the woods in Washington State, salmon were the plaintiff versus the city of Seattle. And this dealt with the lack of fish passage around the hydroelectric dams that feed power to the city of Seattle. And the case was brought by the Sauk Seattle tribe, and again in tribal court. We think a lot of the, since in the West, nature is property. It's tough for judges to get their heads around something different, whereas with tribal courts, it's much easier in indigenous communities because that cultural value, cultural root is there. So those are the three enforcement cases. We can get into more detail on those on the panel, but those are the broad brush three enforcement cases. Next slide. Okay, so much for the dreaded PowerPoint. That's the last of it. We went through this stuff really quickly. On our webpage, we have a timeline of all the international rights of nature developments that's been updated as of March if people want more information. We also do these CLE trainings for the National Academy and the Law Line that do the trainings for the lawyers, and that's also up online if people want more info. And plus, we have this library of ordinances, state statutes, and national laws. And I will, one final thing. just yesterday in the North Carolina House of Representatives, a rights of nature state statute was introduced, a bill to protect the rights of the Haw River in North Carolina. It's the first time state legislation protecting a river has been introduced into the state legislature in the U.S. So with that, that's it.
Great. Thank you, Thomas. So I'm a lawyer. That was my first profession. And I tend to, you know, hammers as a world as nails and really focused in on the legal aspects of the rights of nature movement. But it's sort of just the tip of the iceberg, at least in my understanding. The roots of it I felt like I've gone down this rabbit hole a better way to put it is I've had this like box of experience in our culture. And this movement has forced me to start to understand how the world can be different and step outside my little box. And I was hoping, Elliot, you could talk about other ways of seeing the world, and also the Nez Perce experience of enacting rights of nature legislation as well. So please, have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Todd's mail, it's still morning, right? Good to be here at BSU and on this day. And happy Earth Day, everyone. I'll be talking. I appreciate Tom's presentation. And as pointed out, I was a co-founder of NEMI Group, Protecting the Environment, which is an indigenous environmental organization. And one of our aspects of being a nonprofit is in our education of our publics and our communities. And so starting out with education is so important. And it's even important in these days that there's so many things going on today. I mean, it's just crazy, right? We have court cases that are going on right now to see whether news, and I use that word loosely, news networks have to tell the truth, you know, and the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Rights is meeting this week also. As a nonprofit, we were a NGO. There's our nonprofit is still is existing. I left that to start a different nonprofit up in our neck of the woods. But under that nonprofit, we started to talk about how do we protect the rivers? How do we protect our lives and our way of lives? And so I'd kind of like to start there too. I will be talking about treaty rights, our tribal sovereignty, tribal jurisdiction, and tribal traditional law. And we'll start out with that kind of tribal traditional law. And are there any indigenous journalists in the audience, perchance? What we start out though with is up in my neck of the woods on the Salmon River, archaeologists have found a site where they said that there are our people, the Nimiipuu, our predecessors, that have lived there since for 16,000 years. And so we have stories about that. And so about living in this part of the country. And usually when we start meetings and things, we like to acknowledge that this is not my particular part of the country, and so I have to ask permission to be here, and I have to act accordingly, that I don't disrespect where I am, and I try to honor the people that have been here, that have lived here. And so I would do that ordinarily. I'd recognize the indigenous people that were first here, the Chauvins, Paiutes, and others, even over from Oregon. But so that 16,000 years ago, you know, there's a lot of things going on then too. That was about the time the Bonneville Dam broke. And up in our part of the country, that was the end of the last ice age. And it was coming down. I was in Gonzaga a couple of weeks ago talking about this. And if we would have been back there, we would have been sitting on a glacier, part of a glacier lobe in Spokane. That's how far down the glacier came. And then there was glacial Lake Missoula. You probably have heard about that when it broke and created the scablands of Eastern Washington. And that's our country too, as well as Palouse people and Spokane people, Coeur d'Alene people. And they have stories about living on glaciers and living with ice. But so in that time, we developed a relationship. We developed a relationship with the earth and learning from it, living with it, depending on it. And that's why we call it our Mother Earth, because it's like our mother. It's like your mother. She protects you, she nurtures you, and that's the way we treat our mother and our Mother Earth. And so this is the tradition I come from. And so when we have our conventions, we have to understand the conventions and talking about the law is one of those conventions. Our language is a convention. We all agree that I'll be talking English this morning instead of Nimiipuu. And Nimiipuu just means that's our name for ourselves. Upon contact, we were called the Nez Perce, which is French for pierced noses. But we called ourselves Nimiipuu, so that's why we called ourselves the Nimiipuu Protecting the Environment, because that was our original name. And so we developed that relationship with our mother, then we started moving away from that. And I was with the tribal council, and I was chairman of the Natural Resources Subcommittee. And natural resources is an economic term. And so we were going, well, wait a minute, you know, we can't commodify our natural resources. We can't commodify our resources that way. And so we start thinking about, well, and then we looked around and we're seeing species extinction, we're seeing habitat degradations. And so we thought, well, we need to get involved in this. And that about that time, then we had megalodes coming through our part of the reservation. And those megalodes that Tom was mentioning, I think that headed to the tar sands in Canada. And they weren't even stomping in our part of the country. They're just going through our country. But we were part of that, because this is part of the thing that traditional law, traditional, that kind of our kind of consensus is that we're all connected. We're all interdependent on one another. And so we knew that if we allowed this to happen, that our friends and relatives in the Cree country in Canada would suffer. So we wouldn't allow that. So even the tribal council was out on the highway stopping megalodes from transversing the reservation. And it worked. Those were GE, General Electric, large pieces of equipment. And the tribe beat them. You know, so these things can be done. And so we started looking around again, and we were looking at, boy, we're salmon eaters. There used to be millions of salmon in the Snake River, salmon rivers. And they say that almost up to 50% of our diets and habits and living ways were around salmon. And And so it was so important to us that we included that in our treaty rights as well. We made sure that we had our, that when we negotiated for ceding land, giving land away to the United States so that Western expansion could result, that we would retain our right to fish and hunt and carry on our life ways. And then we started thinking, well, you know, we can't really do that anymore. I can't go fishing whenever I want. So my treaty rights were severely impacted. I've had family members who haven't been able to do that, now they're gone. And so there's a lot, long, kind of sad story about that. But rather than wallow in that, then we decided, well, we've got to be active. We have to do something. And so we started holding flotillas along the Snake River. And that was to help raise awareness of the plight of the salmon. But again, we don't just look at salmon. We have to look at the habitat that it grows up in, the tribes working together. You know, this is one of the things that maybe journalists can help, because you can hear, well, I hear that a lot on news, is that, oh, somebody's going tribal, you know, or they're on the reservation or off the reservation. Negative connotations. You know, and because I know I've worked with tribes all my life in an official capacity and unofficial capacity, and always they've been willing to share. So I just wanted to make that point that are we all seeking the truth? And what is that truth? You know, when we're writing about these things, when we're reporting on these things, you know, now there's, you know, print, is print dead? I've heard that Lebowski was saying that. But anyway, you know, social media is taking over. And how do you manage truth on the social media when we have all of these things? You know, that, as a matter of fact, I think the vice chairman of the tribe, Mr. Wheeler, was down here, and he'll be having a presentation on the myths that involve the breaching of the four lower Snake River dams. And that's what we've been advocating for most recently, is breaching those four dams on the lower Snake River. And that's what we've been talking about, because we've tried everything else. We've spent billions of dollars, ratepayers and everyone else has spent a lot of money trying to bring back salmon, and it has not worked. And so we got to the point, okay, now what do we do? And we have to look at the conventions that are out there. And Tom has helped the tribe and in that regard, helped us. And so we presented a resolution to our general counsel, and the way our tribe is structured is we have our general counsel, which is a voting membership of our tribe, and then we elect a tribal council to represent our interests. And so the tribal council is a policymaker as well as a general counsel. But we took this to the people. We said the people have to act on this. And so we did, and we passed in 02, still during COVID, you know, and that's kind of a bad thing that all of these survivors can relate to. But in 2020, we had a special general counsel where we got a resolution passed, which is now the policy of the tribe. And so now what we do, and that's to recognize that the Snake River is actually a living being. We consider it, as a policy of the tribe, a living being. And so we have, we also established that guardians can represent those interests of the Snake River. And now it is our time to go and work with tribal council and find out, okay, how do we actually put this into effect? How is this policy implemented? And so that's our next step, is that we're doing that. We're seeing, okay, so what are those bundle of rights as they call them, what are those bundle of rights that this river has? Tom says, well, they don't have a right to a speech and things like that, but so we have to figure that out, and we should do that as a community. So I'd like to encourage journalists, everyone, to try to find those mechanisms where we can keep the lines of communication open. Don't just assume that one way of looking at things is the only way of looking at something, because from my perspective, then I come from that tradition where we've had those thousands of years where we've developed this relationship. We've seen what happens when rivers are dammed. You see what happens when animals are decimated. Segments of populations, communities, ecosystems. So we have to be more mindful of that. And it requires us to take some responsibility. And so this is one of those areas that we are taking that responsibility. So let's see. So that was the thing with our treaty rights as well, that even though it says that we have that in our treaty rights, that it still wasn't protected. So this, we felt, well, we'll need another tool in our tool bag, and the rights of the Snake River can provide that. And so what we do encourage then, along with that next step, is to also encourage other jurisdictions, other people to do a similar type of thing. But I think that's about it.
Thank you. So like all of you in the audience, I'm sure I was very diligent about preparing like pages of questions. But I'm also aware that I don't want to be greedy. So I will open it up at this point, since time's running, for audience questions. And if you don't have any, I have plenty. So. All right, that's what I figured. So if you guys know the policy, please state your name and affiliation and then your question.
Hi, my name is Erica Geis, and I'm an independent journalist and the author of Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge, which is really about like changing our relationship with water from commodity or threat to more of a collaborative approach, and there is a little bit in there about rights. I was curious about the precedent that you were talking about in Seattle with the tribal court, and I was just wondering, is there any overlap between tribal courts and the U.S. or state courts where a tribal court can lead to precedent in the wider system?
Make sure to repeat the question.
Yeah, so the question is about the relationship between tribal and state or federal courts, and basically, can we carve out jurisdiction on the tribal end to give the most faithful exercise to these kinds of laws? That's what I heard, at least.
I think I was asking if a tribal court ruling could set a precedent that then made its way into the other legal system. Both questions are interesting.
Yeah, mostly by osmosis that would occur, but no binding precedential value given to the tribal courts. But that comes with a huge caveat, which is this, that in these cases that we talked about, the two tribal court cases, the one at White Earth and the one with the Sauk Seattle, in both of those cases, the defendant, which was either the city of Seattle or the state of Minnesota, sued the tribe in federal court to stop jurisdiction from being acquired by the tribal court. They were so worried about these cases that they sued the tribe in federal court separately to try to get the federal court to intervene to shut down the tribal court as the tribal court was exploring whether to take the case or not. So to insert that is relevant for a reason, which is that sometimes even our allies talk about rights of nature as just being this hippy-dippy 30,000-foot thing. There are folks that understand perfectly well what the reach of this stuff could be if it actually got implemented fully and enforced. And what was interesting about both of those cases is that The tribal litigants, the tribal lawyers, successfully defeated the effort of the state or the city to shut down the tribal court's jurisdiction for them. So those federal district courts dismissed the cases, holding that they had no jurisdiction to hear them, and that the tribal court had to determine their own jurisdiction first before any case might come back to the federal courts. And so it was a victory. Most people want to see those end victories, but these procedural victories to us are even more important in some ways because they build the actual ladder to eventually get to that substantive victory. And I will also say, before the White Earth Band passed their law, they actually went back in and amended their judicial code to give their courts explicit jurisdiction over off-reservation activities. This is one of the big friction points between the federal courts and the tribal courts. Is do the tribal courts have control over what happens off reservation as well as on reservation? There's a complicated test called Montana, which came down from the U.S. Supreme Court, that has a couple factors in it that are looked at in terms of that jurisdiction. But at White Earth, they said, we're going to explicitly extend in writing by amending our judicial code to explicitly give our courts jurisdiction over that off reservation activities that were occurring, specifically that permit issue for the water withdrawal. A lot of fascinating civil procedure, maybe in the weeds kind of stuff among those courts, how they interact. But eventually, we're looking to the tribal courts to be that kind of source of precedent. We think that they're the only capable forum really of dealing with these issues.
In the way back.
Hi, my name's Joseph Winters. I'm a reporter for Grist. Thank you so much. This is a question for any of the panelists. Beyond covering actual developments in litigation or new laws or anything like that, I'm wondering if any of you have advice for journalists who want to incorporate the rights of nature framework into their writing.
So I'll just repeat the question. It is advice for journalists who want to incorporate the rights of nature, the ideas, into their beyond just legal developments.
Thanks for that question. I would think that just from a human level that we can all relate to that, though, right? We can all relate to we want clean air, clean water, right? I mean, so we have to occupy the same space. Let's all agree that we won't be smoking in here, for an example, you know, and so. There are ways that we can do those kinds of communications. And again, I rely very heavily on nonprofits too to get the word out to. For an example, American Rivers, they named Snake River as one of the most endangered rivers in America. And that's the other reason why we had to act, because of the urgency of the situation. But I see a lot of hope going on. That's one of the ways, too, is report on the hope that's going on. I see a lot of communities restoring rivers. Klamath dams are going down up in Washington State. The dams are going down. The dam is going down there. I see a lot of restoration going on, a lot of hope. And that gives me hope as well. Is that we can get together, and these folks are not traditional, they're not indigenous people, but they understand that their community, their environment is so important that it's worth looking into, even to the extent I see farmers and ranchers saying, hey, you know, we invited these beavers back in here to restore this stream, and it's working out fine. We're still running cattle, we're still running our, you know, raising grains, but it's working. So that kind of angle, I think, works.
I just want to add to what Dahlia said. You know, from my time reporting on this movement, I've come around to being drawn more to the cultural aspects. And, you know, when we're sourcing on the story, whatever, on our beats, you know, what ideas are we mainstreaming? What assumptions are we making and sort of unconsciously putting into our stories? You know, are we sort of trivializing the perspective that nature is a living being, that we are part of nature? You know, who are we asking to weigh in on as an authoritative source? And seeing, you know, this movement as being a means of sort of making our laws, our culture more diverse, in Ecuador, for instance, in its constitution, it says it's a plurinationality, right? It embraces plurinationality, meaning that more than one peoples exist in this polity of Ecuador. It acknowledges that indigenous peoples are part of its, you know, they're separate peoples, but they're part of Ecuador. And in the U.S., I just think we're so far from that, of embracing, you know, our first peoples. You know, we're a settler nation. We colonized this land, these lands. Yet we like trivialize the understanding that the first peoples have with Earth. And so it's just made me sort of question, how am I covering things? Whose voices am I listening to or legitimizing? And you get into like legal and political philosophy real quick when you start to go down this rabbit hole, but I think that's a conversation that as journalists we need to start having among ourselves.
Hi, thank you for this. I'm Nancy Castaldo, and I am an author of books that have intersected the stories of non-human rights for animals with this topic. And I wanted to talk a little bit more, or have you talk a little bit more about how those intersect. Is it Ecuador's monkey was not considered like a non-human right, it's considered rights of nature. Can you discuss a little bit of the legalities between those two topics? Because most of these cases are ecosystems, or rivers, versus a species, animal species.
So the question is, the Estrelita case out of Ecuador, and looking at it from an animal rights versus rights of nature, what are the legal nuances?
Right. Specifically looking at like the Non-Human Rights Project.
Yeah,
and they were involved in that. They did an amicus.
Yeah, I remember getting a call from the, I think it was the Humane Society, who wanted to use the Rights of Nature Law in Pittsburgh to free the dolphin that's been kept at the aquarium in Pittsburgh for the last, whatever, 20 or 30 years. And I remember thinking, don't do that, you're going to break it. Yeah, you're going to break the Rights of Nature Law. But we're not in that space anymore. It's, the Estrelita case was really the first one we've seen it, which used rights of nature provisions to pull in that kind of non-human rights stuff. It was the first place I've seen it happen. And, you know, we're always in conversation with Stephen of the Non-Human Rights Project, but that's mostly about individual animals,
right?
Kind of liberty rights, dignity rights for that individual animal. Rights of nature is really about populations of animals. And that's the way I see it in my head, at least, but that may be a distinction without a difference at some point, because it may just all become the same. But, you know, ours tends to be really, really grassrootsy in communities where animal rights stuff is not very popular. And so those communities kind of move with the rights of nature, both because it's the right thing morally and ethically to do, but also because there's a Machiavellian component, which is we need to stop this thing that's happening, and we need to muster as many rights as possible, not just from us, but maybe from these other entities to do so. And I always remember a meeting I had in New Hampshire, backwoods, rural New Hampshire, considering a rights of nature law. And this guy stood up in the back and he said, well, this means I won't be able to shoot squirrels anymore in my backyard. And the guy next to him stood up, he goes, Ralph, it doesn't mean that, it just means that you can't shoot all the squirrels. I was like, wow, that's an interesting translation. Very small place in New Hampshire. So, but that's kind of how we see it in terms of populations versus individual species.
Thank you.
some people in the back have their hand up. Well, yes.
Yep. I'm Brian Jankowski, editor at Environmental Health News. Thanks so much. Thomas, do you know of any efforts to quantify harms prevented or environmental benefits gained, whether economic or ecosystem services, from these rights being established?
Yeah, it's a really dicey.
Wait, oh, sorry. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question was ecosystem services, quantifying harms, benefits, that kind of thing as part of the harms equation for enforcing rights of nature laws. Yeah, it's a dicey subject around rights of nature people because the ecosystem service stuff is really putting a number on and commodifying kind of the service relationship. Just like REV, you know, carbon sinks, carbon markets, there's not biodiversity credits. All that kind of stuff is really about commodifying nature, moving in the wrong direction towards property kind of stuff. And so we generally steer clear of that, but these laws are all different because they're drafted by the communities that write them. We assist them, of course, but they have different standards. So what kind of harm is necessary? You have the precautionary principle built into some of these things, which says we don't need to show harm. If there's a potential for harm, that's enough. But those harm gradients, you know, what do we need to show? In the White Earth case, they were flying drones over areas of water withdrawals to show that rice paddies were being dewatered and that there was an actual real physical impact. These laws don't allow you to just walk into court and say, hey, we have this law, now you've got to stop this project. You actually have to do the hard work of proving the case that if wild rice, for example, has a right to exist, you have to show how this project is going to violate that specific right by using science and data and all that kind of stuff. It just allows you to rewrite the standards and then change who gets into court and what entity is represented when you get there. But there is a circle of people that we deal with who are very much into ecosystem services and are very much into finding ways to allow rights of nature to be part of the framework by which credits are bought and sold. We're just not on that side of the fence.
My name is Ashley Braun. I'm a freelance journalist based in Seattle. My question is for Elliot, and I'm curious, you had mentioned encouraging other jurisdictions to embrace some of the rights of nature protections that the Nez Perce has done. Are there other tribes along the Snake River that are considering these types of rights of nature protections?
So the question was, are there other tribes along the Snake River who are considering rights of nature protections?
Thank you. And kind of following up on my previous questions about working with tribes and the like, we find that it's a good relationship. And that's what one of the conventions that we've discovered as well is that as a Nez Perce tribe, we only have like 3,500 enrolled members. And so as a demographic, then we don't fall into very many categories. As far as that concerns, so it does behoove us to work with other tribes because working together in greater numbers and is important and more effective. And one of the ways that we're doing that now, and we're still working on that, is there's an organization called the Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest Indians, ATNI, and that's an organization made up of 33, all the tribes in Montana, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska get together and talk about issues that are facing us. And we've had a couple of resolutions now before that body where the whole body would look at that and adopt the resolution acknowledging or recognizing rights of Mother Earth. And then that organization then can go to the national organization, the National Congress of American Indians, which is an organization of all tribes in the United States. So then we can promote and advocate on behalf there as well.
Tegan Wendland, the Mississippi River Basin Ag Water Desk. This is so exciting. I love this session. But it's still applying a Western framework to how humans relate to the environment, and it forces us to see natural entities as separate from ourselves and use these imperfect and often colonialist legal systems to fight extractive efforts. So how are you thinking about that, And how can we as journalists help imagine a world where we don't need to use laws to protect nature because we culturally value it?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to do my best to sum that up. So the question is, rights of nature is still a Western conception, rights, and they're being, even when there are rights of nature laws, they're being asserted in Western legal systems. And you're asking, how can we get past, using laws in that system to culturally really embrace these ideas so that we no longer need to, look to permit pollution?
I'll throw the component. Another component of this is that my tradition and cultural upbringing is a spiritual component. Because when you consider everything sacred, then you treat everything differently. Even our words are treated differently. Our words are sacred. We're more careful on our words that we, talk about. And so that's what we base ours on, is the spiritual nature of everything being sacred. But knowing that people come from different cultures, and that's an obvious, how can we do that? We talk about sciences again. Science is real important. You call it the science of ecology, talks about communities, individuals, and how we relate to them. That's another good way of communicating the same thing, essentially, from our sacredness and spirituality, is to rely on science. And then just our needs, our needs for shelter, our needs for food. Food security, requires that we have different agricultural practices and the like. But those are all human needs, and I would rely on that. And I don't know that we can ever change people's spirituality, but that's what we advocate when we go to courts and things like that, because I've seen tribes object to even against satellite, or against science, for an example. The Kennewick man in Washington, we objected to archaeology pulling these bones out of the earth and things like that. They're not treated respectfully, kind of thing. And where there's telescopes on sacred hills and things like that, that's what we talk about, but that's still not recognized within the court system. Even though others have freedom of religion, I can't go and practice that because it's not that convention. And so we're still working from our perspective on how we get those rights recognized. So, but we're trying to help that way too, and by working with people to get the word out. That's one of the biggest ways.
It's two quick things. One is, it's a fascinating synergy, how the tribes basically see themselves as forcibly driving indigenous value systems into a Western system of law through this process. Or the word rights is not easily communicable, so that's a whole different communication there. But I also think the rights of nature stuff, we have a couple projects that we're calling Beyond Rights of Nature. We just finalized a beta project of land that owns itself. Basically, find a way in the law for forests to actually begin to take self-ownership over their own ecosystems. So moving completely beyond this property commodification concept to figuring out a way to do that. And basically blowing up from within that system. So I think it's leading to those other kinds of conversations, but so it's not entirely satisfying as a concept, but it's leading to some of the other stuff as well.
Ian Stevenson from the Idaho Statesman. You mentioned the William O. Douglas dissent in Sarah Blavity Morton, I think, in 1972. Are there any sitting Supreme Court justices who you think are open or amenable to that kind of decision, and what do you think of the chances of getting a majority of them like that in the next 30 years?
Well, so the question is, Sierra Club versus Morton, 1972, Justice Douglas's dissent, are there justices today that would ascribe to this kind of thing? You know, you had me up until the end when you said 30 to 50 years, that was the, because right now it's a non-starter. Getting federal judges to even talk about rights and interests is a non-starter. So we just have to realize that there has to be a grassroots movement built that actually begins to change state constitutions in the U.S. And that's happening in Florida now. There's a First Rights of Nature kind of inspired initiative. They're collecting signatures to qualify for the Florida Constitution. So moving beyond just the local kind of stuff, moving up to that layer. It's about eventually putting judges in a corner where you've built the law, the written law, enough around them so that there's no choice but to do something. And I think, so you're looking at that arc of grassroots activism at the intersection of municipal law, constitutional law, and environmental law in that place. But it's the only kind of change that I can see that's actually going to make a difference. Structural, systemic kind of stuff. That's what rights of nature is. It's not just legalistic, it's bigger than that.
So we're at noon. We started just a little late, so I'll take one more question if that's okay with you guys.
Okay, thank you. I'm Katie Adult from the University of Florida. I feel like he did ask a great question. I was trying to put into words, but just as a follow up, I'm wondering how we can be more intentional with both our writing and our speech to lift up the rights of nature in the life of nature. So speaking on capitalization, like capitalizing animal names, plant names, like how can we as writers do that?
So the question is, how can we as writers and journalists do a better job communicating about the rights of nature? I know what you're saying.
Just like a specific way of writing or speaking.
Like words, terminology.
Yep.
I would be using that kind of voice that going above ourselves and would like to say it. Yeah, without really getting into the spirituality of it, because then we've all been accused of being tree huggers and, you know, those kinds of things. But I would continue to bring the issue up. I think the number of times that we can keep talking about this in the local papers and things like that. Back home, we have to go to the city councils and county commissioners and get that on their agenda so that it starts getting into the community's frame of reference. And so writing to the local op-eds on issues, environmental issues that are coming up from that perspective would be real important. Maybe we should step back. You know, that's a lot of it, a lot is just being able to step back, because some of these projects, we got to get this project. We got to build this dam. We got to, build this road, whatever it's going to be. You know, they're usually on a time scale. Everything is numbers, time crunch. And so if we could just say in this planning process, we need to step back. We need to consider animal. We need to consider the water. We need to consider all of these things before we jump in and just get our objective or, look for our objectives. So I would just keep saying things like that, going to the local community decision makers, for example.
Thank you. So we're out of time, unfortunately. If you guys have questions that you want to ask us afterwards, please feel free to come up. Thank you so much.